The people of Dom Sawat have risen up before. It will happen again, my friends. Stand ready! Stand ready!
The watchmen were now climbing to the crier's alcove. More of them were streaming in from the other side of the gate. But there was another thundercrack, another cloud of orange smoke, and the prince was gone. Almighty God! The crowd quickly lost its boldness. Men and women went back to their business, giving the furious watchman a wide berth. Beside Adula, Rasid cleared his throat, and Adula remembered the urgency of their task. Movement through the tight-packed crowd had been impossible during the prince's appearance, and the crowd moved slowly now.
Come, boy, this gate will be gummed up for hours now. Maybe we can cross over to the avenue and hire a sedan. With all the commotion here, the chair-bearer's gate might actually be quicker than this mess.
Adula tried not to dwell on how much time they'd lost already. Lost time meant more men dead beneath the fangs of ghouls. They walked a half-dozen long blocks and turned the corner into an uncrowded alley. It felt like a different city. The alleyway was cooler, shaded as it was by tall buildings on either side. A hard-eyed woman sat on her doorstep, and she looked up suspiciously from the basket she was weaving when the pair walked by. She and a bone-thin poppy-chewer, who lay sprawled on another doorstep, apparently talking to the clouds, were the only people in the alley. Adula's discerning nose detected stewed goat wafting from a window, and he greedily inhaled the smell.
"Watch your step, doctor!"
Even as the words left Rasid's mouth, Adula felt his sandal sink into a warm pile of camel shit. Adula cursed and scraped his foot on the stone. He turned back to curse again at the brownish smear behind him, and found himself face to face with the Falcon Prince.
Name of God, where did he come from?
The man was nearly 6.5 feet tall, taller even than Adula, and rippling with muscle where Adula jiggled with fat. His black mustaches were meticulously groomed, and his handsome brown face split in a grin. Out of the corner of his eye, Adula saw Rasid turn and draw his sword. The Falcon took a wary step back. The thief looked at Rasid as one might a dangerous animal, but he smiled again as he spoke.
"Well, this is something one doesn't see in every alley. A dervish of the order, and a ghoul hunter. Dr. Adula Maksloud, I would guess."
The prince's manner was strangely casual, given the situation he had just fled. Adula said nothing, but let his face register surprise at being known outside of his home quarter.
"Yes, doctor, I know of you. Had we time, I would repeat all of the praises that I have heard sung of you among the poor of the scholar's quarter. But there are watchmen a few blocks behind me."
"Murderer!"
Rasid spat the word and took a step forward, but Adula threw an arm across the boy's chest. The prince ignored the dervish and spoke to Adula.
"Will you help me, uncle? My next steps and the lives of others depend on whether the watchmen know my true path." "So a ghoul orphaned boy was not enough for old Adula Maksloud today, eh, God? No, you had to involve your fat old servant in a mad usurper's plots as well. Wonderful."
Adula looked up at the prince. He could hem and haw, but there was only one choice here, and this was a matter of moments.
"They will not know your true path," he muttered.
Beside him, Rasid made an angry noise. The prince bowed his head.
"The Falcon Prince thanks you, uncle.
Mayhap I will have the chance to return the favor some day."
The bandit then leapt up, landing on a second-story balcony.
Remarkable.
Adula had seen leaping spells before, but the way the prince's physical grace blended with the obviously magical enhancements was still impressive. With two more quick leaps, he was on the building's roof and lost from sight. Beside Adula, the dervish let out what seemed to be an involuntary grunt of respect. Adula heard the shout and clatter of approaching watchmen.
"We saw him go the other way, yes," he said tersely.
Fury filled the boy's tilted eyes.
"I will not lie to protect that villain, doctor."
"Then conceal yourself, boy, and let me talk."
But the dervish did not move.
"Please,"
Adula urged. The boy shook his turbaned head, but he stepped into the alley shadows, where he seemed to disappear. Two watchmen rounded the corner, running. From the noise, I'd have guessed it was a whole squadron. Belligerent fools. Adula kept himself from darting his eyes about the alley's shadows. He prayed that the boy would stay hidden.
You there, old man! Halt! Halt if you value your life!
The watchmen were both tall, fresh-faced young men. Again they shouted at Adula to halt, though he was standing still. The pair thundered up, and Adula could smell their sweat.
You! Did you see?
That way!
Adula shouted, pointing in the wrong direction. He put on his best, irked uncle face.
He ran down that turnoff! That dirty, damned by God bandit, he nearly knocked me over! What in God's name are you men doing to stop this, I ask? Why, when I was your age, the watchman would never let—
The two men shoved past Adula, running in the direction of his pointing finger. When they were out of sight, Rasid stepped from the shadows. It was Adula's turn to shake his head.
We've lost a lot of time, boy. Looks like we'll be doing some night riding.
Rasid nodded with grim relish.
Ghoul hunting in the dark.
Adula smiled in spite of himself, feeling buoyed just a bit by his assistant's indefatigability.
Aye, and only a sword for brains little madman like yourself would be excited by the prospect.
Not quite wanting to know what Almighty God had in store for him next, Adula gestured to his assistant and walked on. Chapter 4. On the dusty western outskirts of Damsawat, Rasid Bais Rasid watched the doctor huffing as he clambered down from the sedan chair they had hired. Foul tannery smells pierced the air, mixing strangely with birdsong. The buildings here were fewer and farther between than when they were within the walls. Hut-like homes of sun-baked mud and small, prosperous-looking houses of burnt brick lined the road. Even here, where the crowds were much thinner, a motley assortment of people filled the street. Some part of Rasid, intently aware of his surroundings as always, noticed all of this. But his uppermost thoughts were on the brief encounter with the Falcon Prince, and his own conduct during it.
Hiding from men of authority to protect a miscreant. You should have captured him.
The dervish chided himself.
You should have insisted, no matter the doctor's words.
Fara'ad Ez-Hemez was a criminal, after all, and a traitor to the throne of the Crescent Moon, though the doctor insisted that the bandit's cause was just.
The doctor.
Rasid had helped a seditious thief escape justice. And why? Because the doctor had asked it. The wrongness of it struck him anew. It was true, Rasid had put himself into a sort of apprenticeship, and thus he owed the doctor loyalty. But this business with the Falcon Prince. Rasid wondered what his sheikhs at the Lodge of God would say if they could see him now. And he worried, as he did every day, that his actions had displeased Almighty God. How could he know, after all? Every night his meditation exercises helped him to settle his restless soul enough that he could sleep. But it was never easy. A long-haired girl in a tight-fitting tunic walked by. And Rasid knew that Almighty God was testing him yet again. He averted his eyes and smothered the shameful ache that began to fill his body. Life had been less confusing at the Lodge of God, but in the 2 years since High Sheikh Ali, the most venerated and also the most permissive of his teachers, had sent him to train with the doctor, Rasid had learned that the world was complex.
When you meet Adullah Maxlud, little sparrow, you will see that there are truths greater than all you've learned in this lodge. You will learn that virtue lives in strange places.
Rasid had spent 2 years learning just how true his old master's words were. He thought back on the first ghoul hunt he had undertaken with the doctor, when they had rescued the wife of Hafi the bookbinder from the Magus Zaud and his water ghouls. Rasid had begun that hunt amazed that this impious, unkempt man was in fact the great and virtuous ghoul hunter, whom High Sheikh Ali had praised so lavishly. But by the time the wicked Zaud lay dead, Rasid had been forced to see the truth of the doctor's powers, and of his devotion to duty. Even so, in his first days working with Adula Makhsloud, Rasid had thought of leaving a dozen times, finding the doctor oafish and irreverent. But High Sheikh Ali had been clear in his orders, and a new-made dervish did not dare question the High Sheikh. And again, over the past 2 years, Rasid had seen proof that somewhere amidst all of the doctor's belching and cursing and laxity was a fierce foe of the traitorous angel, a man who served God with a soul-deep dedication that was not so terribly different from High Sheikh Ali's, a man blessed by the All-Merciful and beloved unto him. Still, Rasid worried about what would happen when, someday, he returned to the lodge to become a sheikh himself. Each of his actions in the outside world would be judged, and when he thought on his own laxity in matters such as this business of the Falcon Prince, he feared the judgment would not be kind. The doctor turned from paying the chair-bearer and gave Rasid a piercing stare from beneath bushy gray eyebrows.
"You're worrying about that business with the watchman, eh?"
He did not ask the doctor how he knew.
"Yes, doctor. It is just that..."
Upset words burst forth, surprising himself with their intensity.
"Whether or not he is a foolish man, we must respect our caliph and his heir. We must defend them. If that goes, what else will we lose respect for? The ministering angels? God himself?"
The doctor rolled his eyes and scratched his big nose. He put his arm around Rasid's shoulder and steered their steps down a packed dirt foot lane that led to a pair of long, low buildings.
"You know," the doctor said as they headed for the stables, "there is nothing more upsetting than young people who sound like old people. Did you hear your own hysteria? Do you think that there have always been caliphs, boy? God and man loved one another before there were palaces and puffed-up rulers. And if the Crescent Moon Palace crumbled tomorrow, God would love us still. For yea, they are the kings of men's bodies, but God is the king of men's souls."
The doctor's quoting of the heavenly chapters was punctuated by the smell of animals, mule, horse, and camel, wafting toward them as they approached sideways Saeed's stables. The stable-keeper, an impeccably dressed but deformed man whose spine was bent nearly parallel to the ground, came out to greet them, his fine mother-of-pearl worked cane thumping in the dirt. The doctor made the arrangements, as Sideways Saeed was one of his seemingly countless old friends. Even were this not the case, Rasid knew, the doctor would have insisted on doing the talking, as he considered Rasid too naive to be trusted with certain tasks. A month after coming to live in Dom Sawat, Rasid had gone supper shopping. The doctor had laughed at the scant bushel of wilted vegetables Rasid had brought home, asserting irritably that he'd have bought twice as much food with half the coins. Though 2 years had passed since then, Rasid knew his mentor still considered him to be a genius of the sword, but an idiot of the street, as the doctor, quoting some poet, had once put it. A few minutes later, the doctor cheek-kissed and God's-peaced Sideways Saeed goodbye, and handed Rasid the reins of a hearty-looking mule. Leading his own mount back to the road, the doctor looked anxious, scratching at his beard and glancing about him as if searching for something. Rasid guessed that it had to do with departing from Dom Sawat. Leaving the city behind seemed to make the doctor fidgety and melancholic by turns. Rasid did not think he had ever met anyone so attached to a place. The ghoul hunter complained about city life often, but Rasid knew that he loved it. Perhaps because the King of Cities was a place that the doctor could complain of familiarity, comfortably, endlessly. Rasid hoped it would please God to bring this good, if flawed, man back to his city soon. He pledged silently to use his sword arm and his virtue to make it so. They reached the road, and the doctor mounted his mule with a series of grunts and huffs from both him and the beast. Rasid eyed his own mule again. He'd had little need of steeds or pack animals in his solo travels. "The true dervish needs no horse," said the traditions, and his sheikhs at the Lodge of God said that Rasid was the fastest dervish the order had ever seen. He could run for miles without tiring. As far as pack animals went, the traditions were equally clear. The true dervish needs no more than he can carry on his back. Still, the doctor always traveled by beast, and called it show-offish when Rashid insisted upon walking beside him. Rashid had taken to hiring mules and sedan chairs along with the doctor, just to keep from hearing him complain.
"Just for that? Or because you have grown lazy and he gives you an excuse?"
His own reprimanding voice echoed through his head. Next time he would walk, he resolved. They spent hours riding, moving past suburbs and outlying farms until there were no signs that they had left the world's greatest city behind them. There were few people moving along the hard-packed road now, only one or two carts or camels at a time. Since leaving the lodge, Rashid had spent little time outside of Damsawat, and as he rode he marveled again at how the sky seemed to open up above them. Finally, when the sun had sunk halfway to the horizon, and they were alone on the road, the doctor brought his mule to a halt, struggling briefly with the beast. Rashid pulled up beside him.
"Well," the doctor half shouted, "this is as good a place as any to cast the tracking spell. Come."
He gestured Rashid to the side of the road and dismounted with a loud grunt. The doctor then reached into his satchel and hunched down to the ground with an even louder grunt.
"He is always making rude noises," Rashid thought with irritation. "Grunting, scratching, laughing too loudly. But it is my duty to keep him safe."
In one motion, Rashid also dismounted, gathering the reins of both mules and standing over the doctor protectively as he worked his spell. The doctor had pulled out a bit of paper, the bloody scrap of the child Faisal's clothing, a vial, and a long platinum needle. He wrote something on the paper, pricked his finger with the needle, and pinned cloth and paper both to the ground. Then he stood, closed his eyes, and recited from the heavenly chapters, sprinkling out a dark green powder. Mint? With each name of God he spoke.
"God is the seer of the unseen. God is the knower of the unknown. God is the revealer of things hidden. God is the teacher of mysteries."
Nothing happened, so far as Rashid could see. But the doctor, his brow sweaty now, opened his eyes and took his mule's reins from Rashid. He remounted and continued down the road. He said nothing, not even turning to see if Rashid was following. As Rashid mounted and trotted up beside the doctor, he realized why.
"He's winded. The traveling, the spell. It's all taking its toll on him."
Rashid tried not to be worried by this. Rashid gave the doctor a few minutes to catch his breath before he spoke.
"You have found the ghoul's trail, doctor."
"Aye,"
was all the doctor said. Mile after mile they rode the mules at a brisk walk, moving at a slant toward the sinking sun. As the road veered further west and closer to the River of Tigers, the land swiftly sank and grew marshy. The air grew more humid, and more gnats filled it, irritating Rashid's eyes and nose. When the sun was touching the horizon with pink and purple, Rashid saw a scrawny, bearded farmer walking toward them, the only traveler they'd come across in an hour. The man gave the mules a wide berth and mumbled, "God's peace," from the opposite side of the road as they passed, avoiding eye contact.
"Is he afraid of us, or does he have something to hide?" "He is not why you are here,"
Rashid chided himself.
"Stay focused."
The landscape was dotted with large boulders that might hide anything. Rashid watched for signs of movement about them. The River of Tigers lay just out of sight on their right, its presence indicated by a clean, wet scent, by date palms, and by the great patches of steel reed that clacked in the evening breeze.
"Stop!"
The doctor spoke the word loudly enough to startle two marsh birds into flight. It was the first time he'd spoken in a long while.
"The trail veers off here, but something is not quite right."
"What do you mean, doctor?"
Rashid's mentor looked truly confused, a rare sight.
"I don't rightly know, boy. In all my years of casting tracking spells, nothing like this has happened. Normally I feel, maybe better to say, I hear within my mind
gods prompts in the direction of my quarry, and this is still the case. Our prey is close, and in that direction.
The doctor pointed off the road to the left, toward a dense patch of boulders and a lone hill with a pointed top.
But I also hear his hints about other dangers. The jackal that eats souls. The thing that slays the lion's pride. I don't know what it means. In all my years, I've never...
The doctor let go of his reins and held his head in his hands. Rashid tried to hide his worry. The doctor took a deep breath and noisily exhaled. He looked up, shook his head, and ran a hand through his beard.
Gone. Whatever it was, it's gone.
He looked around as if he'd been woken from a dream. Another deep breath, and an exhalation loud enough to be a camel's.
Forget it, boy, never mind. I'm old and tired and haven't had enough to eat today.
Rashid's mentor clearly did not believe this, but if the doctor wished to say no more, Rashid could do little about it.
Let us continue,
the doctor said, turning his mule off the road and picking his way downward with the slight decline of the land. Rashid followed. After another quarter hour it was dark, save for the faint light of the stars and the moon, hidden behind a silvery shroud of cloud. They came to the base of the point-topped hill, and Rashid saw that it wasn't a hill at all, but a sloping rock formation that jutted up 50 feet from the ground at an angle, like a tiny mountain. The doctor guided his mule's steps onto the rock, and its hooves clopped loudly against the stone. Behind, Rashid rode his own mount up the incline as it steepened sharply. The doctor, following prompts that Rashid could neither hear nor see, then turned to ride across the huge wedge of stone. The precision of the rock's triangular shape and the smoothness of the stone made Rashid wonder whether the slope they were riding across had been shaped by men. If so, what sort of men walked on it?
Doctor, where does this stone come from? What building once stood here?
Rashid asked quietly. He prided himself that he did not feel fear easily, but there was something troubling about walking across the floor stones of the long dead. The doctor spoke distractedly, looking all about him as he did.
It's from the Kem Empire, that's for sure. Maybe the cornerstone of...
The doctor let the sentence die on his lips and drew his mule to a sharp halt, the animal objecting noisily. He narrowed his eyes and peered about.
Dismount,
he whispered, and clambered off his mule. Rashid obeyed. He gathered both animals' reins, but let them fall as the doctor whispered again.
Let them go. No time to tie them.
Again Rashid did as he was told, and the beasts trotted down the slope toward a patch of thorn clover near the stone's base.
Bone ghouls. More than one. Nearby,
the doctor said, cocking his head. It looked as if he were listening to something inside his skull. He shot his big hand into his satchel.
Bottom of the slope! He barked.
Rashid did not ask how the doctor knew. He drew his sword and scanned the near darkness below them. Suddenly the mules began braying fearfully. Rashid's keen eyes made out their dark shapes, fleeing the stone slope. Then he saw other shapes, manlike. One, two, three of them, stepping from behind boulders, moving up the incline, and he heard the hissing. The hissing of ghouls was like no other sound in the world. 1,000 serpents rasping with a man's hatred. Rashid had heard the sound more than once, but it still made his skin crawl. The clouds blew across the sky, and the scene below them was bathed in moonlight. Even the doctor's old eyes would be able to see plainly now. 3 bone ghouls, all claws and jaws and gray skin, were scrambling up the slope of the huge stone block.
We have gone from hunters to prey, doctor.
The doctor grunted and pulled something from his satchel. 2 of the 3 ghouls had closed to 20 yards. The doctor regarded them coolly, held aloft a small, stoppered vial, and threw it to the ground. The glass shattered. The smell of vinegar and flowers filled the air, and the doctor bellowed scripture.
God is the mercy that kills cruelty!
There was a sound like a landslide, and the two closest ghouls, their false souls snuffed out, lost their man-like shape and collapsed into piles of turned earth and grave worms. Two of the monsters at one stroke. Not for the first time, Rasid marveled at the doctor's powers. He felt reassured to be admiring his mentor and not fearing for him. One of the ghouls still stood. The doctor leaned forward with his hands on his knees, clearly worn out by his spell.
Your turn, boy.
Even as the words left the doctor's lips, Rasid sped toward the last creature, his sword flying out in search of ghoul flesh. The thing hissed with mindless malevolence and raked its long claws, but Rasid kept it at a double sword length's distance. He danced in two steps and slashed out, feeling his sword bite into the monster. There was a loud hiss, and the ghoul's severed claw went arcing through the air, maggots dripping forth like drops of blood. One of the maggots landed on Rasid's cheek. The ghoul didn't even pause. It swung out with its mutilated stump, and Rasid took a darting step back, not daring to brush away the itching insect. The ghoul pressed in, but Rasid had the advantage now. The creature didn't feel pain, and one clawed, it could still have easily killed most men. But Rasid was not most men. He snaked left, then right, always keeping the ghoul's good claw at a distance. He waited for an opening, and found it when the thing lunged at him with its snapping jaws. Rasid shifted, brought his sword up, brought it down. The ghoul's head flopped from its shoulders. Its body trembled and dissolved into a pile of maggots and grave soil. Rasid brushed a maggot from his face and stepped back to the doctor's side, finding him winded but unharmed.
Doctor, where do you think...
More hissing. The words died on Rasid's lips. Two more bone ghouls clambered up from the ledge of the sheer far face of the stone block.
Merciful God!
Rasid had fought bone ghouls since joining the doctor, but always one or two of them. He had known a ghoul pack of this size could be made. The doctor still huffed beside him, likely unable to work another invocation so soon. Rasid charged at the ghouls, his two-pronged sword out to his side as he slashed past them. His sword bit into one ghoul's neck, was nearly wrenched from his hands. He drew the blade back and kept moving. He dodged claws, drew their attention away from the doctor. The ghouls pressed him back until his heels were less than a yard from the cliff edge of the massive stone block. He tried to get a glimpse of the doctor, but the creatures blocked his view. Maggots dribbled from one ghoul's neck wound. That one staggered, its energy clearly unfocused. The other stared at Rasid with empty eyes. Some vicious, unliving instinct within the monster was weighing when to strike. The doctor's big, white, caftan-clad form shuffled forward, shouting. His voice was weak as he pronounced,
God is the hope of the hopeless!
The wounded ghoul collapsed. The other one flew at Rasid. The wind was knocked out of him as the monster slammed into him. He scrabbled back two steps. The ground gave way beneath Rasid's feet. He and the ghoul went plummeting in a tangle of limbs over the edge of the stone block. Rasid tensed his body and focused his soul. He twisted, letting his sword fly from his hand and kicking the ghoul away as he fell. The rocky ground rushed toward him, but Rasid was calm within the slow-time sense of his training. His acrobatic skill was God-blessed, beyond that of any rope dancer or tumbler. This fall would not harm him. He tucked himself into a ball and hit the ground rolling with only a hard grunt. He continued the roll for another 20 feet and stood, panting. His eyes caught the moon glint of his sword a few feet away, and he scooped it up, reassured by the familiar feeling of its hilt in his hand.
Where is the ghoul?
Rasid looked around, bracing for another fight. He saw the bone ghoul 10 feet away, sprawled on the ground, twitching. The monster had landed head first, cracking its skull open upon a sharp man-sized rock. The thing hissed feebly, twitched once more, and dissipated into a heap of dead vermin.
Praise God!
Only then did Rasid allow himself to feel the stinging pain across his chest and ribs. The thing had raked him with its rancid claws, shredding his silk robes and grazing his flesh.
The wound will need herb purging.
The doctor had taught him some time ago that the old tale of ghoul wounds turning men into ghouls was nonsense, but the charnel monster's dirty claws could still kill with any number of very real diseases. Rashid heard the doctor shouting from the top of the stone block. Still more of the creatures? He ran to the sheer face of the block and started climbing with the speed that ordinary men found so amazing. The doctor had already been exhausted when he'd spoken his last invocation. In such shape, he was a poor match for the minions of the traitorous angel. Rashid climbed faster. He ignored his wounds and the painful scrape of rock against his fingertips and hoped he wasn't too late. Chapter 5. Abdullah had begun this battle feeling like a cocksure young man. He'd sensed the ghouls early, dispatched several, watched his assistants sever another ghoul's head. But that first burst of nostalgic bravado was gone now. Abdullah didn't doubt that Rashid had survived that fall, but he might need Abdullah's help, and there might be still more ghouls about. Abdullah was drop-down tired, but professional pride and worry for his assistant kept him from collapsing. He turned toward where Rashid had fallen, digging into his satchel again and producing a small vellum envelope. Something at the edge of his vision moved toward him. Abdullah spun away from whatever it was. Something heavy struck him across his back. He went sprawling, the envelope and his satchel flying from his hands. A large form snaked between him and his bag. Stubbornly, he pushed away the pain in his back. He scuttled away from the creature, breathing heavily as he came to his feet. Abdullah shouted out in shock. Another bone ghoul. A massive bone ghoul. The largest ghoul he'd seen in 40 years. Impossible! To make a creature of that size along with all of these others! The power involved was incalculable. The creature towered over him, and he was not a small man. Who could make and control this 9-foot monstrosity? It took a step toward him. Abdullah looked from the thing's soulless eyes to its broad claws. One of those claws could crush his head like a melon. Indeed, only his half-conscious dodge had saved him from a broken back. And despite the world-weariness with which he faced each day, Abdullah was not ready to have his head crushed like a melon just yet. If nothing else, Rashid needed him. He stared into the ghoul's flat, pupilless eyes. Softly, desperately, he began to whistle, "Under the Pear Tree, My Sweet." As soon as the first notes left his lips, the monster froze in its tracks. A confident gaze and the ghoul's soothing sound of a favorite song. It was an unreliable, old womanish charm, with none of the power or grace of scripture invocations. Sometimes it didn't work, and when it did, it was effective for only a minute or so. But it had saved his life more than once. The huge monster's claws were draped at its sides, and it swayed slowly with the tune. Abdullah tried to whistle, hold the ghoul's eyes, and consider his options all at the same time. The phrase, "I am too old," kept getting in the way of his thoughts. "Not now," one part of him barked at the other. His satchel, with all of his components, lay on the ground just past the giant ghoul. It might as well be in Rugalbeh. If he took a step toward it, he'd break the whistle charm. He kept whistling, but he was coming to the end of the song, and thus the end of the ghoul's soothing. Abdullah prayed that the ghoul's claws would not catch him when he dove for his medicine bag. He didn't like his chances. "This is it, then," Abdullah thought. "An ignoble death, courtesy of a hissing abomination." He couldn't say he was surprised. "What I wouldn't give for one last cup of cardamom tea, or one last meal in my townhouse." He weakly whistled the last note of the tune through dry lips and tensed his muscles. The creature squealed. Then something leapt at the ghoul. It wasn't Rashid. Abdullah saw a flash of golden fur and a lashing tail. Some sort of animal had fastened itself to the giant ghoul's back. The monster's milky white eyes widened and then contracted. It squealed again in pain. Abdullah shoved melancholic thoughts to the side and tried to gather facts. What had hurt the ghoul? And how could Adula use it to his advantage? The gray-green monster twisted as it tried to shake this new attacker from its back. As the ghoul turned, Adula got a better look at the extraordinary animal that had saved his life. A sleek she-lion with eyes like green fire and an impossibly shimmery gold coat. Adula's mind raced with remembered lore. Not an animal at all. In fact, if the desert legends were to be believed, a creature such as this was an agent of the angels' justice, and thus of God's. Adula said a quick, silent prayer of thanksgiving. Still, God helpeth most the man who helpeth himself. Adula risked grabbing for his satchel. By the time he scooped it up and had his hand in it, though, he saw an invocation would not be needed. His rescuer had snuffed out the false soul within that monstrous mock human frame. As the thing died, it burbled in that manner that still, after all these years, turned Adula's stomach. Then with a sound like the scrape of a great grave lid, the ghoul crumbled, a carpet of cemetery soil and dead coffin moths spilling forth. A bright flare of sun-like light rippled out from the lioness's coat. When the flare subsided, a plain-faced brown girl of perhaps 5 and 10 stood where the lioness had been. She was dressed in the simple sand-colored camel calf suede of the Bedouin tribesmen. It was as if Adula had blinked and someone had replaced the razor-mawed creature of a moment ago with this green-eyed little girl. It wasn't the first time he'd seen such a thing. The rare, almost forgotten gift of the lion shape. He had known another tribesman thus gifted by God many years ago, a good man, first savage, but terrifying to witness when crossed. Adula would have to tread carefully here. Hello, he managed. The girl stared at him with those emerald eyes, wary. God's peace, he tried. The girl's expression softened almost imperceptibly, but she was still hard-faced.
God's peace,
she said curtly, brushing her coarse shoulder-length hair from her eyes. A girl of her age speaking to a man of Adula's ought to have been more respectful in her tone. At the very least, she should have called him uncle. But the uncouth Bedouis showed no decorum to any save their own. The girl followed her first two words with barked questions.
You were fighting these foul creatures. It was you who destroyed the others?
Indeed, Adula said, holding back the admonitions that were on the tip of his tongue.
Thank you for your help, child. It has been many years since I've been face to face with one who was gifted with a lion shape.
The girl's mouth fell open.
You know of the gift, and you do not fear me?
Adula shrugged.
You're used to dealing with your ignorant fellow tribesmen, no doubt. Feared you even while depending on your powers? Well, I am no ungrateful savage.
The girl growled at the insult to her people, as if she were still a lioness inside. Adula put both hands up placatingly.
I am a scholar of such phenomena and of their dark versions, girl. The lion shape is a gift given to men by God through the angels. You, true Bedouin, watch for the angel boon. Mane of golden sun, claws of silver moon. The shape is known to me and is nothing to fear. Besides, after 40 years of ghoul hunting, it takes more than a child wearing the shape of a lion to frighten me. Though I am surprised. It has been 20 years since I've met one of your kind, and I didn't know that the gift could be visited upon girls.
Adula heard the faintest whisper of noise as Rasid hoisted himself up the sheer face of the stone. The girl turned at the sound.
Well, boy, it's about time,
Adula said as the dervish came trotting up,
leaving an old man to fend for himself up here. Though, as you can see, we are not alone.
The boy's sword was already in his hand, but his expression was more incredulous than battle-ready.
Who is the girl, Doctor?
Well, among other things, she was the instrument of God's ministering angels preserving my life, but we've had no time for proper introductions.
Adula turned to the girl, who was studying Rasid.
I am Dr. Adula Maksloud, young woman.
My assistant is called Rasid.
A cold wind picked up, and Abdullah folded his hands beneath his armpits to stay warm. The girl frowned again.
You are a ghoul hunter, and this one is a dervish?
She asked brusquely, without taking her eyes off Rasid. Abdullah arched a displeased eyebrow at the ill-mannered child, though he wasn't sure she saw it.
I am, and he is. But I thought that even the rudest of Bedouin would have better manners than to nose into a stranger's business before even giving their name.
No hint of embarrassment crossed the girl's features.
I am Zamia bin Ulaith Bedouin, protector of the band of Nadir bin Ulaith Bedouin.
Abdullah glanced at his assistant. It was only then that Abdullah really saw the blood-stained slashes in Rasid's blue silks. The cuts didn't look deep, but Abdullah knew from experience how they burned. Of course, the stoic boy would show no sign of complaint. But herbs were needed there. Ghoulsbane and lavender. Abdullah was no healer, but his friends Dawood and Litas had taught him some little bits.
You're hurt, he said to his assistant, reaching into his satchel and producing a poultice pouch.
He tossed it to the dervish, who sheathed his sword with clear reluctance and began mashing the pouch in his hands, preparing it for application. Abdullah's nose twitched at the floral pungency of the herbs being crushed. He looked back to the girl.
Zamia here can take the lion's shape, boy. You do recall my lessons on the old powers of the Empty Kingdom's desert tribes. She just destroyed the largest ghoul I've ever seen.
The dervish's eyes widened, and his hand stopped squeezing the pouch. He frowned slightly.
Impressive, Doctor. But the traditions of the Order say, being my enemy's enemy does not make you my friend.
Well, do a little dance, boy. For once those old hypocrites of yours had something wise to say. But I am not calling her a friend. I am simply saying that she saved my life.
The girl spit.
Vile men! Do not speak of me as if I weren't standing before you!
Tribesman's speech had always sounded to Abdullah like rocks talking. This rough-looking girl sounded like a grating rain of pebbles. She focused her angry young glare on Abdullah.
What are you doing out here, old man?
Doctor, girl. You will call me doctor, or uncle, or something more respectful.
Angel chosen or not, Abdullah had had enough of this rude little girl's tone.
The Bedouin owe no allegiance to city titles,
she said sneeringly. Then, reluctantly,
But I will call you doctor if you wish.
An even more arrogant expression spread across the girl's homely features.
You say with your own tongue that I saved your life? This means that you owe me a debt of death.
Abdullah barked out a laugh.
Such notions these people have. Ha! Does it now? I am a ghoul hunter, girl. Do you know how many lives I have saved? How many men and women and children I have kept from the claws of monsters? Did they pledge their lives to me? Did they become my slaves? No. This is a relic from one of your people's ridiculous six-hour, six-night story poems.
The girl growled again, but said nothing. Abdullah sighed.
Look, you asked in your mannerless way, what are we doing here? Well, as it stands, this ghoul pack slaughtered a marsh family a few days ago. My assistant and I...
I saw them,
Zamia interrupted, and it was as if all of the arrogance had been bled from her voice.
I have been tracking these creatures for almost a week now, since they left the deep desert of the Empty Kingdom. I found the marshmen after they were killed. Their rib cages cracked open, their hearts ripped from their chests, and their eyes. I've seen dead men before. I've killed men, watched life's light die in their eyes. But this was... There was no brown or black or white in their eyes. Only red, not blood. A glowing red like nothing I've ever seen. If that is what it means to die beneath a ghoul's claws.
The girl shuddered, folded her arms around her boyish frame, and fell silent.
Adula as well found himself momentarily speechless, eyes bright with the color of the traitorous angel. More evidence that there was something here even grimmer than the hunting of ghouls. His insides clenched in fear.
Bone ghoul or water ghoul, sand ghoul or night ghoul, the unholy monsters eat the still warm hearts of men. But this business with the eyes is something still more horrible. A cruel kind of magic, a form that the old scrolls say has vanished from this world. A sign that not just the flesh, but the soul itself has been sucked away and swallowed like marrow.
The girl's green eyes widened with shock.
Such a thing is not possible.
Rasid, whose hands had been moving beneath his tunic as he applied the poultice, spoke before Adula could answer her.
The girl is right. God would not allow such a thing. The heavenly chapters say, yea, though the flesh is scourged, the soul of the believer feels no...
Please, boy, no scripture quoting. Your inadequate interpretations help nothing here, and my energies are needed for more important things than enlightening you through exegesis. Now...
Zamia tilted her head and sniffed.
You're telling the truth,
she said in a suddenly weak voice.
I smell no trace of deceit upon you.
And tears began to well up in her eyes. Adula was perplexed.
And I smell no deceit upon you, Zamia Benu Laith Bedawi. Though, despite its prominence, I'm sure my nose is not quite as accurate as yours. But now it is my turn to ask questions. Why these tears now? And how is it that you came to be here alone, stalking these monsters? Where is your band?
That is none of your concern,
Zamia said, her words wooden and heavy as she wiped a few tears from her plain face. The wind whipped up for a moment, the sound blending eerily with the harsh call of a hunting nightkite.
We clearly share an enemy, girl. Surely even a tribesman can see that we should share information as well.
The girl's eyes tightened, and Adula recalled a favorite saying of Miri's. Bees and beetles alike love honey more than vinegar. That Miri rarely followed this dictum herself meant little. Adula needed to try a different tack.
Zamia, I don't mean you any insult. I know what it is to lose your happiness to the ghouls. And I can help you, girl, if you let me.
When the girl spoke, it was with the voice of a dead woman.
I lied. When I spoke of finding the marshmen's bodies, I said that I had never seen such a thing. I lied. I had seen it days before. It happened to my band.
So that's it.
Adula reached out a comforting hand to the girl, but she stopped him with an angry look. She swallowed, wiped away another tear, and continued.
I was out scouting one night far ahead of the rest of the band. The next morning when I returned to where they'd set their tents, what I found?
The girl's matter-of-fact tone slid away. She fell silent, her eyes wide with remembered horrors. Then she smothered her pain again and went on.
Bodies. All of their bodies. All 57 of the Benu Laith Bedawi. Old Uncle Mahlud and spoiled little Awazi. Faziza, who believed that she really ruled the band. My father, my beautiful young cousin, who would have been chieftain. His body had been burned. All of them, do you understand me? I am the last.
It had the sound of something the girl had been repeating to herself. Adula did not speak, hoping the girl would go on.
There were foul, puzzling smells everywhere,
she said after a moment.
Jackal scent, where no hair could be found. Fresh spilled child blood that smelled of ancient buildings. But these scents led nowhere. The only sign I could find was this.
Reaching into her tunic, the girl drew forth an ornate, curved dagger. The blade was stained with what looked like dried blood.
It was my father's. He had it in the folds of his chieftain's robes. There is blood on it, but the scent is neither man nor animal. And if the stories are to be believed, ghouls bleed no blood.
Adula's mind raced, recalling the strange phrases that had come to him earlier when he'd sought God's help in finding the ghouls. The jackal that eats souls. The thing that slays the lion's pride. He turned the lines over in his head, but still came up with nothing.
"Generally the stories are not to be believed," he finally said to Zamia. "But that one at least is true. Which means that your father wounded something or someone else. God willing, that dagger may hold answers."
"God willing,"
the girl replied, though she didn't sound as if she held out much hope.
"I have been trying to find the trail of the creatures for days now, seeking to avenge my band so that I may die with honor. I came upon them almost by accident, just as they attacked you two."
Zamia was quiet for a moment. She swallowed and then spoke again.
This soul-eating, this is what they did to my band."
It wasn't a question. She looked straight ahead as she spoke, and her now dry eyes looked almost soul-eaten themselves. She held the dagger aloft.
"This is all that I have of my father, though I will never wield it. For since I was given the lion shape, I forswore other weapons. My claws, my fangs, the silver knives with which the ministering angels strike. This is the old saying.
God save us from the poetry of barbarians."
But the words were as bitterly spoken as any Adula had ever heard. He had seen God alone remembered how many pained faces during his career. But looking at the pain on the face of this rough little girl who was a lion was not made easier by that history. Still, he knew that unlike most victims he had dealt with, this one would want and need hard truth more than coddling.
"Listen to me, angel-touched one. Your family is dead, in body and soul. I can offer you nothing that will change that, but I can offer you a chance at vengeance."
It was the only thing a tribesman could want right now, Adula knew.
"You may travel with us as an ally if you wish. Zamia Benu Laith Bedawi."
Beside him, Rasid made a choking noise. Adula had almost forgotten he was there.
"Doctor, we cannot have her. There is no reason to..."
"Humph! You forget yourself, Rasid Besrasid. Who is the mentor and who is the assistant here, boy? Besides, we need Zamia's knife to find the one that did this. The ghoul pack has been destroyed. Now we must find out who made it. And we must kill him. Unfortunately, my tracking spell has taken us as far as it is going to take us."
"Can you not work another spell, then?"
The girl was tense. If she was wearing her lion shape, her tail would be switching, Adula thought. He ran a hand over his beard.
"My invocations have their limits, child, just as your powers do. The chapters say the mightiest of men is but a slim splinter before the forest of God's power."
He pulled out the scarlet-spotted scrap of cloth that he'd used in his tracking spell.
"The blood on this was spilled by the ghoul pack we just destroyed. That is how I was able to track them. But the pack's master, the true murderer of those marshmen and of your band as well. Well, God requires more from us to find him. The blood on Nodder Benulaith Bedui's dagger is a good start. May I?"
he asked, reaching gently for the weapon.
"You recalled his full name,"
the girl said, her angry face showing what Adula supposed was a savage's respect. She handed him the dagger with an anxious look in her eyes. Adula had to nurture that respect if he wished to have the girl's help without her arrogance and second guessings. Besides, he found that he was desperate to offer her some sort of comfort. He held the blade aloft and squinted at it.
"Your father wounded this creature, Zamia. With this weapon we can find the thing and its master and destroy them. Your father has served your band to the last."
He handed back the dagger, But the girl's face was blank now. She said nothing.
And why am I trying to indulge her incomprehensible tribal foolishness anyway?
He got back to the matter at hand, making his tone coolly professional.
A man with the power to make such a ghoul pack, and to command these cruel old magics, will have powerful screening spells at his disposal. He knows I am looking for him now, and he will prepare countermeasures. Even with this trace of blood, his trail will be impossible to find without the aid of an alchemist. Praise God I happen to know one of the best in Damsawat. She does not work on the road anymore, but she'll help us nonetheless. We'll return to town tomorrow.
The girl's eyes flashed, and Adula saw all his progress fly away.
Tomorrow? Why do we not return now? I am looking for the dog that murdered my band, you fat old fool!
The little Bedouin's expression was petulant and murderous. His temper's fire flared, and Adula had to remind himself what this savage girl had suffered. Still, he would not be told what to do by a child, especially not a child with the gritty accent of a sand-behind-the-ears Bedouin. She needed to be reminded of what was what.
Listen to me, Zamir bin Ulith Bedouin. These are deep, dark waters we are in here. We need help, but before that, we need rest. You may eat with us now if you wish. We will return to the city tomorrow.
Angel touched or not, at bottom the girl was just another wounded child of God with a monster problem. Adula had learned over the years that those whom he helped needed as much as anything to be told what to do. After a moment of silent seething, the girl seemed to come to the conclusion that she had little choice but to obey him. She ran a hand through her hair, drew herself up, and put on a neutral face. She ignored the invitation to eat.
Very well, Doctor. Tomorrow,
was all she said. She gave Rasid an unreadable look, then trotted toward a large rock overhang. Adula watched her disappear behind the rock. He turned to his assistant and caught the boy half gaping. The dervish shot his eyes to the ground. Adula knew this was not the time for ribbing, so he restrained himself. Instead, he simply said,
"You fought well today."
He always felt awkward bestowing praise, but it did the self-doubting dervish good. Rasid's yellow-brown cheeks reddened ever so slightly, and he bowed his head in acknowledgement. He was as uncomfortable receiving compliments as Adula was giving them. Perhaps, Adula mused, this had something to do with why they worked well together. The boy cleared his throat.
I will go and retrieve the mules, Doctor. They can't have gotten far.
Tension was evident in his voice.
He's more troubled than usual. What is it, boy?
Adula asked bluntly. The dervish seemed to think for a moment before speaking. He adjusted his turban.
The Falcon Prince. A fierce ghoul pack. An angel-touched girl Bedouin. Enough wonders and monstrosities for a lifetime. Does this day not trouble you, Doctor?
Adula shrugged sleepily.
More than I can say. Still, I've seen worse, boy.
That was a lie, of course, but it earned a brief, impressed smile from Rasid. The dervish nodded once, and without making a sound, stole his way down the sloped stone. He watched Rasid's swift steps and felt a stinging envy for the tirelessness of youth. For a few long moments, Adula just stood there, listening to the insects of the night and wincing at the pain across his shoulder blades. There was a great stone scrape across his shin, too, that he'd been too tired or too frightened to notice. He wondered if there was any inch of him that had not been slashed or bruised at some point in his life. Then he made his way carefully down the slope. A few minutes later, Rasid returned, silent as ever, but betrayed by the noise the mules made as he led them. The beasts themselves seemed to be unharmed, praise God's small providences. Adula had always found mules to be admirable animals, intelligent and suspicious of authority, but maligned as obstinate and ill-tempered.
Not unlike me.
The boy produced a small bronze cookpot and prepared a simple soup over a sputtering fire. Out in the cold night, something small squealed as it died.
"Perhaps the girl is out there hunting up supper,"
Adula mused, not sure if he was joking. Rasid was clearly preoccupied as they set to their bread and broth. There was more to it than the horrors and wonders they'd seen today. Adula knew the cause, though he doubted the boy had yet admitted it to himself.
The girl.
No doubt the dervish was twisting himself in knots, trying to square the circle of his pious oaths with the young man's natural reactions, and only half aware he was doing so. When Adula was a young man, he would have told the girl that she had a lovely face and been done with it, though this particular girl did not have a lovely face, exactly. No, the girl was not what anyone would call pretty, but she had a rough, vital energy that clearly spoke to Rasid. But the boy was incapable of being honest with himself, let alone with a woman. Adula faulted the rigid lodge of God which had trained the boy into being a sword of a man. Then again, Adula himself hadn't known a woman's touch in a while. He glanced and occasionally winked at young women, but he felt awkward doing anything more. And among the older women, there was only one who mattered to him. Miri. Before he fell asleep, Adula let his thoughts linger for a while on Miri Elmusa. The great love of his life's warm, welcoming curves danced before his mind's eye, and he could almost hear her heavy, husky voice whispering loving taunts in his ear and offering him tea cakes. His eyes fluttered shut, and he drifted toward sleep, already half dreaming of swaying hips and sugar frosting. And again a small animal cried a death cry out in the darkness. The war is upon us, the slaughtered calf screams, and thieves in the night have stolen my dreams. The line from Ismi Shihab's Leaves of Palm came to Adula unbidden. With a dejected snort he rolled over and resigned himself to sleeping alone on a pallet on the cold, hard ground. Chapter 6. Zamia bin Ulaith Bedawi stretched and flexed her muscles by the light of the still-rising sun. She sipped from her water skin, pulled on her gazelle-hide boots, and packed her bedroll. Just as her thoughts went to last night's battle and to her new allies, she caught the approaching scent of the dervish Rasid. A half-moment later, the lithe little holy man peeled himself from the shadows of a rock not 10 feet away. She felt a flash of shame. No man or animal had ever gotten so close to her without her scenting them before. The last traces of the ghoul pack's corrupt stench had blown away on the night wind, and she was better rested than she had been the night before. She had no excuse. But when she did get a clear scent on the dervish, she was shocked out of her self-scolding. Ministering angels, help me! She had never been in the presence of a scent that was so strong, yet so clean. Zamia found her shame deepening, but for new reasons. It was all she could do to keep from staring at the pure-smelling, clean-shaven little man in blue. She made a small, surprised noise.
"God's peace,"
the holy man said by way of greeting, his angular face unreadable.
"God's peace,"
Zamia repeated. The morning air felt warm and thick in her lungs.
"I apologize if I startled you,"
the dervish said flatly.
"We are packing up and we'll leave soon."
She snorted.
"You didn't startle me, and as you can see, I am ready to leave already."
The dervish bowed his turbaned head.
"Of course."
Even standing at ease here, he had an air of war about him. Zamia would have known that the little man could fight, even had she not seen his handiwork against the ghouls the night before. The dervish's confident grace as he moved, the hardness in his tilted eyes, the way his hand rested naturally on his sword hilt. These were signs her father had taught her to recognize in an enemy or an ally. Though she could not say why, Zamia found herself recalling the taunts that two of the boys in her band had made, never to her face, about her rough, ugly looks. They had been jealous of her power and renown, no doubt, but It had never mattered to her before whether their insults were rooted in truth. The dervish was staring at her. She scowled at the little man.
What is it?
A tiny lizard darted across the rocky ground between them. Rasid eyed it for a moment, but looked directly at her when he spoke.
I have been wondering about something, Samia bin Ulaith Bedawi. From what the doctor has told me, it is not your people's way to seek help from the outside. I know that you have lost your band, but why have you not sought out the help of the other bands in your tribe? Angel-touched or no, you are young to be on your own, so.
Young? I am 5 and 10. How much older are you, little man? 2 years at most?
Samia sucked her teeth in annoyance.
But he is straightforward, at least. Not like the doctor with all of his words and smiles.
The dervish held her eyes with his, and something powerful moved through her body.
At our last tribal council, my father's band was water-shunned by the other bands of the tribe,
she said finally.
Because of me. Because he dared to name a girl child protector of the band, and now...
She laughed bitterly, despite herself.
Now I can't even avenge my band, for no Bedawi will answer my rally. And so I have failed as protector.
Samia finally stopped herself, not quite believing she had just spoken those words.
Why are you telling this stranger about this? Because his scent is clean? Because you will fight beside him? The tribe's business is the tribe's. The band's business is the band's.
The dervish scratched beneath his blue turban.
But you...
We will speak no more of this,
she said firmly.
What of you, Rasid Besrasid? Where is your kin? Why have you no family name?
She found that she could not quite keep the scorn from her voice.
No kin? No band? No tribe?
Her stomach clenched as she realized that the same could now be said about her. The dervish sighed, and then recited what seemed familiar words with a quiet intensity.
My name is Rasid Besrasid, the old way of saying Rasid, only Rasid. I am a dervish of the order. I need no father among men. I need no brother among men. I need no son among men.
He drew up to his full height, which somehow seemed taller now.
God is my father. The forked swords of the order are my brothers. Virtue is my son.
They were mad words, Samia knew. For what was a person without family? Yet she found herself moved by them, and intrigued by their stern-faced speaker. Again shame crept up within her, wearing the bloody bodies of her kin. She had no right to be looking at a man so. She was the protector of the band,